So you may or may not remember that spare rib by 1979 was there. It was reaching a kind of crescendo we represent the women's movement, and we are one of the many voices of women's liberation, and it was beginning to reflect in its pages the conflicts and dissents and very difficult times that were to gather speed over the next decade. So one of them was around lesbian issues, but it was not the only one. So to divide it out is to leave behind the horrible conflicts over the accusations of anti-Semitism that we went through a whole period of that, and then big time conflicts around race and racism. Now, I'm saying that we can't leave them out because we can't, but if we want to use a dreaded word now that I wouldn't have used previously, intersectionality, many of the women who would have been involved as lesbians were also involved from their own personal positions as Black women or as Jewish women or as whoever you were in some of those other conflicts. I don't really sort of know what would be of interest in this. I feel as if I've written an awful lot about it with my friend Susan Ardell about the LGBT, not LGBT, because I've only just started using that phrase, because that's what we use at Age UK now.
What about what you told me once before about the complaint that there was too many lesbians taking
Well,
over the paper?
yes, there was. I mean, the voices of lesbian readers, the voices of lesbians on the collective, did grow stronger and more obvious, and one of the ways that happened was for demands to have more articles about lesbians and lesbianism. And that did not lead to an onslaught of articles, just all by lesbians. However, the conflict that was growing, and it wasn't just in Spare Rib, as always, it was reflected out in the women's liberation movement as well. Was, as I remember it, that women who felt, I think, pushed into a corner, heterosexual women, who felt pushed into a corner by the demands of lesbians, by accusations of heterosexism, by, the real criticisms that heterosexual women had passed over lesbian realities and not reflected them at all within the writings that they did, left them out, or worse, were anti-lesbian without possibly even knowing it. And so we were, all that was coming up in our letters pages and in some of the articles that we were writing. And then there was one particular group and woman in particular who wrote in. I can remember we discussing it fully, that the spare rib was being taken over by lesbians. It was sort of like everywhere you turn, there they are. They've taken over. So I think it was Susan Hemings took a year or two issues and went through them and actually counted the number of articles there were that were about lesbians or lesbian issues, whatever. And it was some very small percentage. But to me, the interesting thing was that this woman was not stupid, and she wasn't trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. She actually felt that that's what was happening, and I think that that was quite common that women felt that their position of they didn't want to be in a position of superiority, or they didn't want to really think that they were excluding anything. But in fact, it was very uncomfortable, to say the least, to be women in the women's liberation movement fighting against male supremacy, and suddenly have lesbians turning around and saying, you know, come on, you're behaving in a terrible way, you're making, you know, your heterosexism, your anti-lesbianism is, you know, hurting us, it's wrong, and you should get a grip and stop doing it. And of course, this was happening with black women too. So for white women, in many ways, white heterosexual women in particular, were white middle-class heterosexual women, because it was the time of the hierarchy of oppression. So you kept adding these things on, and these women, poor women, that I just escaped because I've just become a lesbian, were being accused of all sorts of things that I think, you know, they'd never got to grips with or even considered when they became part of the women's liberation movement. Red Rag was London-based, and it was started by, I think, in fact, I'm totally confident about this, by women in the Communist Party. And they came together and produced one or two, maybe even three, but I don't, maybe that many issues. And then at the time, in the 70s, the Communist Party, the CP, was influenced by, you know, was there were a lot of women who were joining the CP who were in the women's movement, and women from the CP getting involved in the women's movement. So there was a lot of interchange going on between Communist Party women and women who were joining. People like one of the most famous would be Bea Campbell, but many other women. And I think it was a party policy that if you were, they wanted the Red Rag to be a broad movement, what they called a broad movement publication. So it wasn't to be only CP women. They wanted to involve other sympathetic women, women on the left. I mean, they weren't, you know, but so it was, did not announce itself in any way whatsoever as a women's magazine of the Communist Party. It was not meant to be that. It was the left's, in its own very particular way, it was their intervention in the women's movement, but not as a, not like a Trotskyist group. It wasn't trying to get members. It wasn't trying to sign up everybody who, we all knew, all of us who were non-aligned socialist feminists knew that it had been started by the CP. We knew all the women on it who were in the CP. There was no secret.
Were any of them lesbians?
Sorry?
Do you know if they, anyone involved in that magazine were lesbians?
Well, Bea was on it. Was she a lesbian at the very beginning? Everybody was in a kind of transition. Angie Mason, Elizabeth Wilson, all lesbians. I did that piece with Susan Ardill called Upsetting an Apple Cart, SM in the London Lesbian and Gay Center. Have you ever read that?
No.
Oh, well, you might find that quite interesting. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. It's about the conflict. And
was those conflicts and those arguments related in particular to that center, or just that's happened to be where
it, no, it
those
was,
discussions
it was,
were held?
It was where those discussions were held, but it was also about whether policies. And there was the grouping of lesbians, mainly, who were completely opposed to the center being open to overtly identified SM practitioners. You know, because around that time, I mean, it was mainly guys, but it would be guys sort of wandering around with chaps on or, you know, something ludicrous looking, but, you know, something that was very much an SM look. And a number of those people, they had meetings there, SM meetings about SM. And the same kind of grouping of London, there was a group called the North London Lesbian Mothers Group, or the North London Lesbian Mothers Group. Those are some people who still don't talk to me, but you should probably try and see someone from there. You know who might be good? Miriam McAlpine was in that group, but she's much more, I don't know whether she'd be willing to talk about it now or not, but she's more approachable. A woman who I used to be really close friends with who just completely blanks me still. I think we sort of go like this. Hello. Hello. Lynn Harn. She was part of that group. And Sheila Jeffries was, they were all kind of aligned with Sheila. And they were completely opposed to having any SM presence within the London Lesbian and Gay Centre. And we had the most tortured, to use the wrong word, discussions about what should be allowed and what shouldn't, you know, down to the minutiae of costumes.